You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Joanne Ramos.
Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity, but it can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal, like spending less than 1 hour per day on email, to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours a day on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off our Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time with Rescue Time. Business Essentials for Writers, How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you have never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. Meet all the people and jobs in the publishing industry and how they fit together. Building the foundation of your business career, including paths to publication. Understanding sales and marketing and publishing. Establishing all of the operational side of any business, from contracts and intellectual property. Working with different tools and technologists, and how to design and build your website. Learning how money works as an author, basic accounting, and making more money. We look at all this and more from a long-term strategic view. How to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work together. It's Business Essentials for Writers by James Nettles. Kick. The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1 by John L. Monk. A supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it, and he does, every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Every Day, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed yet likable main character. Kick by John L. Monk. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Joanne Ramos on the show with me. She has a fantastic new book called The Farm that is making a lot of waves and made a lot of waves in pre-release, and now it's out now, and I'm excited to talk with you about it today. Welcome to the show, Joanne.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, so it starts really early. My first book was written when I was 5 or 6 because my parents brought home, it's when we still lived in Puerto Rico, they brought home a Cinderella board book and I copied it down word for word on scraps of paper and then I illustrate them and that was my book. And that was one of my favorite childhood activities. And then when I was in the first grade, after getting my first communion through our church, they gave me my first diary. And so I've actually kept one since that day. I have hundreds of them, little ones, big ones, ones with locks, very painful ones to read. So I've been writing really my whole life.
That is fantastic. So it sounds to me like your parents definitely encouraged this activity.
Yeah, well, they encouraged me to read. And I think the writing just, I sort of took up on my own. my mom, I think, has never talked about it in depth, but she always liked to write. She never pursued it as a career. And I think some of that is the generation that she was in. The fact that we did emigrate from the Philippines, that's where she grew up her whole life. And it just, I don't think was in her mind to necessarily do that. But when I used to look in the books that were stacked all over the house, I would find scraps of paper with her handwriting on it, with words or phrases she liked and wanted to look up, or little quotations she'd write down. So it's funny, now speaking to you, I really need to ask her more about that, but she always loved words. She always loved words, and I definitely got that from my mother.
It's so amazing when you can look back and see that influence and see that, you know, just that quiet encouragement that's never kind of lorded over, but you just see it happening. And I think that makes a huge impression on kids.
Well, it's funny. I haven't really thought about that till you asked me now. And I just said this, this process of getting the book written and published has been such a whirlwind that I honestly, until you asked that, didn't sit and think that it really was my mom planting those seeds and maybe wanting on her own to write. I need to ask her. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I love hearing those early influences and things, because they do follow us through life. And I think, as you know, as a writer, as an artist, there are a lot of a lot of dark, lonely days, and being able to look back and see those things and reconnect with those early influences, I think are a huge help.
No, I agree. I definitely agree.
Yeah. So you've been a lifelong journaler and diary keeper. Is that something that you continue today?
I do. The only time I didn't keep a diary, consistently didn't keep a diary, was when I started having kids. I had three kids in relatively quick succession in my 30s. And I was tired. And honestly, I love my children. I loved having my children. But those early days, if you kept a diary, they'd be the same.
Right.
Like, I washed the bottles. I fed the baby. I didn't sleep. I washed the bottles. I fed the baby. I changed that. So there was a period there where I didn't. That was the only period since I got that diary in the first grade that I didn't keep a diary relatively consistently.
My wife and I have five kids, and they were roughly 2 years apart. Roughly, some a little more, some a little less, and yeah, that there's a decade that's just lost to redundancy and diapers.
Exactly. So you could keep a diary, but you may just want to photocopy one and then just paste them together for your diary.
Yeah, what's the use? And it would be gravely depressing and all of that.
But
So what was the thing that brought you back around to writing? We all have this these times where we have to pursue life and family and all that, but there's something that brings it back up. What was that thing for you?
So I didn't go into writing out of school, and I actually went into finance. I worked on Wall Street and at a private equity firm right out of college. And I thought about that a lot, because since the journey of this book started, people have asked me, oh, you majored in English, or oh, did you take a job at a magazine, or where did your writing career begin? And it didn't begin then. And I thought about that a lot. I think in part it's because I was born in the Philippines. We did move to this country because my parents wanted more for us and felt like America was a place that we would have that. And I was never told by my parents to be practical, but that was always somewhere. I always knew that I had to be. And so I journaled, and once emails were invented, I wrote 1,000, 2,000 word emails to friends that were almost like essays. But I didn't turn to writing until I had paid off in that debt in my mid late 20s. That I could really make a break. And even then I stayed practical and I went into financial journalism. I got a job eventually. It took a while at The Economist, covering banking and finance. And that was as close as I got to writing a book, even though I'd always wanted to write a book since I was a kid. I loved stories. And really what happened is when my third child, flashing forward now to me turning 40, 41, my third child was finally in school. And I'd been home for a bit, and I thought, I'm ready to go to write again. And I thought about returning to The Economist, and I realized that I didn't want to. I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a book about all of these ideas that had been accumulating in my mind for so long. And so I just committed to it. And from that point, I wrote every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, while the kids were in school, trying to find my way into all of these themes that had obsessed me, rooted in me being and Filipina in Wisconsin in a town without that many Asians in it, rooted in being a financial aid kid at Princeton, one of the wealthiest universities in the world, a woman on Wall Street during a time where there weren't very many women on Wall Street, a mother during an era of helicopter parenting, not from this world of privilege that I ended up in, and feeling right. A little funny about the things that people felt their kids needed or deserved. All of this stuff I've been thinking about for so long, and so... I really finally committed when I turned 40. I think it was that cliche, like, I'm 40, midway through my life. When am I going to do it if not now?
Right.
But it took me a year and a half until I found my way into the story. And that was because I read a snippet of an article in the Wall Street Journal about a surrogacy facility in India. And that set off all of the what ifs in my head that eventually led to me writing The Farm. But the big leap was deciding to give it a go when I was 40, and that year and a half that I persisted. It was kind of depressing. I didn't know what I was doing. It was like day in, day out, stacking up pages that I would bin because they weren't great. I've read them recently. Oh, they're not great. They're really not great, but maybe that's what I needed. Maybe yeah. I needed that year and a half to be open and ready for The Farm when it happened. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I want to back up just a minute to the, mm-hmm. the financial journalism, the first part of the transition for you. I find that fascinating. That was that for you the bridge that just allowed you to use your writing muscles and not feel guilty about it?
I think so. You know, okay, so this is I don't know fully why I'm telling this rather personal story, but when I...
That's what we do here.
Left. Okay. When I left finance, I left thinking that I would still go into the business side of a media company. I was hovering, like trying to get closer to something creative, but I was too scared. Honestly, I'd paid off most of my debt, but not all of my debt. I wanted to be able to make a living. I didn't want to ever have to worry about money again. And so that was my plan. And then it turned out I couldn't get a job in the business side of media, probably because they could tell that I didn't really want a job in the business side of media. And that was a year or two of looking for jobs I didn't really want, that people could tell I didn't really want them, and so they didn't give them to me. And my then friend, who then became my boyfriend and eventually my husband, I remember he sat down and he said, you write these 2,000-word emails and they're beautiful and you love writing. You're always reading and you're annotating books. And why wouldn't you try to write? And I got very angry with him. And I said, well, it's easy for you to say, you know that you love business. You're going off to business school. Your dad was a surgeon. Like, easy for you to say, I can't write. I mean, I need to make my way. I was so angry, disproportionately angry, because I think he'd hit on something true that I wasn't ready yet to face. And that night I stayed up all night. I couldn't sleep. And that morning I remember I called him very early and I said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to try. But the not exciting part of the story is I was like, I'm going to try to get into financial journalism because which is not the romantic ending to that story. But to me, it was still writing. It was still a break from a path, which was finance and business, where I could definitely earn a living, to something less secure, less well-paying, and that I wasn't sure that I could get into. But I wasn't yet ready to make the leap to say, I don't know, I'm going to waitress or fact check so I can write fiction. I couldn't, that wasn't even part of it. I didn't even think that far. I thought to try to get into journalism was hard enough. And honestly, I wasn't wedded to financial journalism. That was my only way in because I didn't have clips. I had no experience. And so when I did try to get jobs at the New York Times or other places without clips, they steered me towards, they're like, use your background, look at the business journals. And that's what I did.
I think it's really interesting, this feeling, because I think a lot of us have that feeling is like needing to earn your way in and needing to, you know, I I'm not ready yet. I haven't done what I need to deserve to be a writer yet. And I think a lot of us go through that. And it sounds like your journey, and especially that year and a half where you were trying to find the story, was kind of removing some of that weight. That instead of earning your way in there, it's really already in there. You've just got to connect with that story.
I think so. I mean, look, this is my first book, so I can't speak very broadly, or at least to a broad experience.
Yeah.
But I feel it's funny. So much of my book is really about hard work and also luck and that fine line. And I call the question a lot about this idea of just deserts or meritocracy. But I even feel my book is that I know I worked hard, and I know, but I also looked on that article. I've had friends say to me, you're still too self-deprecating, you know, that you wouldn't have noticed that article and made that into a book had you not done the work before for that year and a half. And maybe there's truth to that. All I know is that year and a half, I was writing short stories, flash fiction, first chapters to novels that went nowhere. I just couldn't find the story that would allow me to write about all these different things I've been thinking and feeling for so long until I happened upon that article. And what if I hadn't happened about that article, happened upon that article? I don't know.
So what was it about that article? You said that you read this article and the premise just lit your brain on fire, my words. What was it about it, and what did it start to open up in you that the farm eventually came out of?
So the article, from what I remember, it was two paragraphs long. So it wasn't the article itself, or maybe three paragraphs. I think it was that I already was circling around a couple of characters in the book, both of the Filipina baby nurses, basically. And I felt there was something there, even in the little flash fiction pieces that I wrote about them, because I'm very interested in motherhood. I'm interested in inequality and how unequal mothering has become, not only because wealthier women can outsource, you know, caring for their kids to women who've left their children behind in another country to take care of other people's kids. There's that. But there's also, with this leap and pressure to be a perfect parent, and, you know, these $3,000 strollers and the tutoring and the money now makes mothering very different across the spectrum of society. And so I was already interested in that. And the little stories and bits and first chapters I was trying to write were very focused on one family, like maybe one wealthy family with their Filipina nanny who also lived in a dormitory in Queens, things like that. When I read the surrogacy article, I think what happened is I realized that the bigger questions I had about our system, about meritocracy writ large, about the idea of the American dream as a broad American narrative, was something I could tackle if I made a corporation, if I suddenly made a surrogacy facility where wealthy people were hiring women who tended to be desperate and tended to be immigrants and tended to not, you know, have a lot of other ways to give their children a better future. That just opened up a whole nother level of, I don't want to say critique because I'm hoping to raise questions, but I guess critique that wouldn't have been accessible to me if I wrote an intimate story about one family, their caregiver, and her family. I think that's what it was. All I know is the what if started. I was like, what if I get out of India? What if I put it in America? If you were a billionaire and you were to hire a surrogate, what would you want? And that was pretty fun. I was like, oh, I'd want to stick Mozart in there because you read about Mozart. Oh, you'd want organic food. Oh, you'd want daily massage so the woman would never be stressed because you have to worry about your cortisol level. And that part was actually quite fun to do, to come up with a world.
You said that you had a couple of characters that were already kind of hovering around and looking to find their place in your mind. When this premise came along and all of the what ifs started, did those characters begin to fall into place for you?
Only in the sense that, so I didn't know her name was Jane. I knew I wanted to write about a young mother who takes a baby nurse job or some set of job and had to leave her infant daughter at home. Something about that really resonated with me. And once I stumbled on the article, I said, okay, well, that woman, who I will call Jane, will work at this surrogacy facility. And she will have to leave her little baby, 2-3 months old, at home to work in the surrogacy facility. So it's and the other character who I already had is Ate, who is this older baby nurse, sort of the baby nurse to the stars, or to the, she has quite a reputation in New York and quite savvy. I thought, okay, well, she is someone I feel who would, in a weird way, respect the farm or Golden Oaks, because she is someone who, in another world with a few more opportunities, would have been really, really successful as deemed by society, I think. She's a hustler. So she kind of slotted in too. So that's what was great about the construct. Like right away, I found a place for the two women I couldn't figure out what to do with. And then I built on that.
You you mentioned earlier that throughout your life, you've had this feeling of being not fish out of water. That's a kind of cliche, but this not exactly fitting, being the odd person out in a lot of different situations. Does that idea and that the empathy that comes along with that bleed into the characters in this book?
I do think so. I don't know that I can draw a direct line, but I think that, and again, I write, I don't outline, and I wrote this quite intuitively, but looking back and thinking on some of the choices I made, I think the reason that I put in such different characters, I know the reason I put in Mayu, who's the woman who runs this farm, and the reason I tried to make her complicated, and I also tried to make Ate complicated, and all of the characters complicated, is because I have straddled a lot of worlds. Many of us have, but in doing that, I've gotten to know and befriend people from both sides of a lot of divides. And so when I talk to a set of my friends, let's say on one side of the divide, who tend to vilify the people on the other side of the divide, I have a harder time doing that because I sit on both sides. And I, one of the challenges that I kind of set for myself in writing this book was to not create villains or saints, to make all four of the narrators complicated enough that the reader wouldn't be able to make one, or, you know, to consign them to one box or another. And maybe in that way, question things a little more, because you weren't able to blame the system or the outcome on one thing. Because when I think of some of the things that bother me or about the world as we have it now in our society, there aren't easy explanations. And I don't think they're easy bad guys. And when people say that they're easy bad guys, whether it's the fat cat Wall Street bankers or the whatever Mitt Romney called them when he said they're the creators and the people who sort of the freeloaders, that gets us nowhere. Well, I forgot the quote, but
yeah, it's something ludicrous like that. Yeah.
Right. It was something ludicrous like that. So that was one of my, and I think for me, that comes from this shape-shifting that I did so much, and the straddling and the balancing and the trying to squeeze myself into different worlds. I think you learn something, too, by never quite being a part of anything. I did. And at the very least, you learn empathy.
Right. So how long did it take to write this book?
So there was a year and a half of writing in the dark, which I count. And then once I came upon the idea for the surrogacy facility, it was about three and a half years, including the editing. Three and a half years till I sent it to a handful of agents in hopes someone would rep me.
Well, it's it has kind of caught fire in pre-release. What was the, once you got representation and they started shopping it out there, what was the process like?
So the whole thing, even the repping, was not what I expected. It was so fast and furious that my head was spinning. And so I sent out my manuscript to, I'd read in, I think it was Poets and Writers, or somewhere I'd read that you send out your manuscript to four or five agents, and then as they reject you, then you pick the next four or five. And so I did send it out to four or five agents in mid-December, a year and a half ago about, and then in a couple of days I had my first offer, and it just went from there. It went great. When we and then I picked one of the agents, and we edited furiously to get it out by the London Book Fair, or at least have it ready by then. And when she started shopping it, we sold it, I think, in 4 days, 5 days. It was fast. It was really overwhelming and wonderful, but overwhelming. Like my kids who've been with me through this whole process and my husband, I heard my kids at one point talking to my husband, like, why is mommy crying so much? We thought she'd be so happy. This is everything she wanted. And I heard my husband saying, oh, she is happy. It's just, she's also very overwhelmed. It's just how she, it's just a little too much for her right now. It was so funny. I honestly never imagined. And when I was writing it, I was writing it because I had to tell, I just wanted to tell the story about these ideas. And I, because I don't outline it, was, I had to finish it for me too. I'm like, where does this go? How does it end? Did I want it to be sold and read by people? Of course I did. I did, but it wasn't at all at the top of my mind. I was just sort of in it. And so to come out of this 5-year long, very lonely, private world, and then have it taken up like that was incredible and so lucky and very overwhelming. And I still feel like we're on that journey because it happened so fast. We edited it so quickly and we got it out and we were, it may sound crazy to people who aren't in publishing, and I thought it was crazy. I would have thought this was crazy 2 years ago, but a year and a half isn't very long in publishing to get a book out. It's just been so intense the past year and a half.
Well, it has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of early reviews and just so much positive reaction. How does that make you feel with this, when there's so much history in this book and so much of your... of your personal journey in this, and now to be completely finished with it, and you know it's completely out of your control, but then see that people are really connecting with the book. How does that strike you?
That's it. So you basically said it, and you said what I didn't know before and that I was scared of. So I was really worried about this part, and I still am. I'm not the most.
This is the terrifying part. You know?
It's so scary. It's so scary. You know, it's also when you're, if you're naturally a writer, not maybe not everyone, but many people I know, you'd like to write. That's your best mode of communication, right? Or for me, it is. I like to think about things and write them and edit them. And so there's so much public speaking now, and it's all so new. I will say I just turned 46. Not everything or most things in my life are new, but every week at the least, and sometimes every day, I am doing something I've never done. I'm a little nervous or very nervous or flat out terrified the first time I had to give a big talk. It's all fresh tracks. And however stressful that has been, and it's been sometimes stressful because it is new, it's also exhilarating and it's also a privilege because to be able to stretch and grow at my age is pretty cool. It's a pretty lucky thing. So that's part of it. And the other part is I was worried about this, what I thought would be a very static part of the journey. The book is done, it's bound, I can't change it. But what I've realized is that it's not static because I'm meeting with people who not only really have reactions and opinions about the book, whether they like it or not, but they've really grappled with it. And so we end up, I mean, it's still a conversation. That is what I didn't expect. And that's why I'm actually a lot more hopeful talking to you now than even a month ago when I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this part? Because I have been learning most interviews I have. I'm like, oh, I never thought about that. Thanks for asking. And I come up with a new answer that I didn't even know was my answer. Now ask me in a year, like, does it get old in a year? I don't know. It's not yet though. It's still discovery, which is super cool. I'm just hoping that lasts. I don't know how long that lasts, this stage.
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
So.
But I love what you're doing, Joanne. Big fan of the book, and can't wait to see how it's going to do and what comes up next from you. If people are just discovering you and want to connect with you, is there a place online that they could do that?
Yes, I have a website. It's www.joanneramos.com, and then I am relatively newly on Instagram, so it's at Joanne Ramos, the farm.
Awesome. We're going to send everybody to see you, and congratulations on the book launch, Joanne.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
The ancient building wore the severe cassock colors of a Puritan minister, a uniform monochrome of slate-gray shingles and soot-gray clapboards, its shadowed upper windows cross-hatched like the facets of a spider's eye. The second story protruded beyond the first and bore the house's only ornament, two gray teardrops of wood, weeping from each corner of the building's stiff upper lip. The place would have looked sinister and foreboding in its shadowed alley if not for the die-cut silhouette of a dancing sheep, jaunty above the door, and the two front bay windows that blazed with colorful, welcoming light. The windows were hung with orbs of colored glass on staggered lengths of ribbon. Each orb glowed with autumnal reds and delicate greens, burgundy tints and pumpkin hues, dappled raspberry and clover lime, streaked with light and weightless as bubbles over a cauldron. The shelves below offered crystal skulls and silver daggers and horny devils, Celtic chalices and woven dream catchers in dreamcoat hues. A primitive broom leaned in a corner, ready for flight, and a rhapsodic nude in bronze clutched her goat-legged lover beneath a jackal bust of Anubis. The interior of the shop was even witchier. Above a crude and sooty fireplace, a stack of brick barely holding the shape of a chimney pushed through the barn-high roof, threading ancient beams that crisscrossed overhead. Brooms and kettles and Christmas lights dangled from these, alongside Halloween costumes and Chinese umbrellas, pointy hats and bundles of herbs. Jason wandered deeper into the shop. His fingers trailed across strange bronze statuary and Aztec masks of turquoise and lapis lazuli. He rolled his eyes at the luck candles and money charms, but goggled indecently at a nude and anatomically correct silver nymph with long golden hair that reminded him of Kate.
"See anything you like?"
Jason jumped, turned, and jumped again. The woman standing before him was the living embodiment of every hippy-dippy counterculture type he'd ever seen. Her hair was green, her face pale and round, her doughy body wrapped in some elaborately woven ethnic garb. Her eyebrows were black and pierced in little rows, and her eyes were heavily circled with midnight blue, as if she'd been sucker-punched by an oil slick. She tapped the glass over the nymph.
"Admiring the goddess, I see."
Oh. She'd practically caught him with porn.
"You want to hold her? She won't break. Here."
The woman flipped open a glass door and handed Jason the naked figure.
"See how heavy she is? You could bang her against the wall all day and barely make a dent."
She waggled her eyebrows, obviously enjoying his discomfort. He checked the price tag.
$700? "The goddess is a symbol of love and fertility. Don't be ashamed of desiring her."
The woman's long green fingernails plucked a long black cigarette from a long red case, and she lit it.
"I sense,"
she blew smoke and studied its whorls,
"dissatisfaction in love. Yes, I have just the thing."
She pulled Jason into a side room where the smell of her clove smoke gave way to the skunky aromas of potpourri sachets, tea leaves, and hanging clutches of twiggy flowers. She searched, found a little bundle, and pressed it into his hand.
"This will make you irresistible. Rub it on your nethers twice a day, and love shall surely find you."
Jason made a face. The bundle smelled like cow manure. He didn't even want that on his hands.